people, and convincing in my deceit I can be. Right, I come from a little small town called Millen, Georgia. And every year in Millen, Georgia, they have this thing called the Fair on the Square. And it's like our little festival, right? The community comes out and there's funnel cakes and, you know, little old shit that we do. Can I cuss?
Yeah.
Little shit that we do. And this particular year, they brought a gorilla as an attraction. And so we all from the country, we ain't never seen no gorilla. I was, you know, 14 before I saw a pig. So a gorilla's a big deal. And they bring this gorilla in, and everybody pays $5, and you walk through there, and you get to see it, and the show's over, and everybody goes back home. And next morning on the radio, we hear that the gorilla has escaped.
Oh,
right? And said, do not approach this gorilla because he's a wild animal and he's dangerous. If you see him, call this number. So I didn't think much about it, right? I wrote the number down just in case I saw the gorilla. And I'm standing there washing dishes, and I looked out my back window, and I saw the gorilla. Right? He came across the backyard, lumbering like gorillas do. Comes up this big, tall, straight pine tree in the very back center of my yard, and I'm just standing there watching, right? I'm kind of dumbfounded about this gorilla. He skinnies up that tree. So I'm sitting there getting thinking, I said, well, shit, I reckon I ought to call the damn number they give me. So I called the number, and the gorilla wrangler answers. And I know it's the gorilla wrangler because he said, gorilla wrangler. And I said, man, I've got your gorilla in my backyard. I got him trees. And a pine tree out back, you need to come over and get him, right? Well, I'm expecting the SWAT team to show up. Because this is a gorilla. And this old dude pulls up, pulling a trailer that's got a cage on the back. And on the side of the truck, it says, Gorilla Wrangler. And he gets out of the truck and walks around to the passenger side. He's getting the tools out. He pulls out this long stick with a point on the end of it. And he pulls out a set of handcuffs. And this little dog jumps out. And he reaches in the glove box and pulls out a pistol and gives it to me. And he said, all right, where's the gorilla? And I said, man, I said, it's just you? He said, yeah. I said, you're going to be able to get that gorilla? He said, I do this all the time. I said, all right, yeah. Let's see it, right? I said, if you don't mind my asking, though, how in the world are you going to take these tools and get that big-ass gorilla out of that tree? He said, well, I'm glad you asked. I'm going to skinny up that tree beneath the gorilla. And I'm going to take this long stick with a point on the end of it, and I'm going to poke him in the ass with it. Now, when I poke him in the ass, he's going to let go of the tree, and he's going to fall and land on his back on the ground. And when he does that, that little Jack Russell Terrier right there is going to run up to it and grab him on his gonads just as hard as he can clamp down on him. And, of course, he's going to grab himself. And when he does that, I'm going to put these handcuffs on him and put him in the truck. I said, all right. I said, so why didn't you give me this pistol? He said, well, there's always a chance when I poke that gorilla in the ass, he grabs the stick and knocks me out of the tree. If that happens, I want you to shoot that dog. So now you know I'll lie to you, right? I go by the name Roscoe. I've been called that since I was in high school. It's easy to remember. I answer to it. I answer the phone as it. But anytime I'm speaking, I use my government name, and that's Stephen Rothborough, and I am alcoholic. Now, I use alcoholic because my experience, I learned how to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. It always had trouble reconciling my experience to an AA talk, because most of my experience was drugs. And so as I start kind of doing this, and I start thinking about page 44 of the big book where it's got a two-part question with an or in the middle of it, because I've gotten qualified, right? And I've definitely qualified to be in a Drug Addicts Anonymous meeting. I qualified to be in an Opiate Anonymous meeting. I qualified to be in a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And I know I qualified to be in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because when I start, when I honestly want to, I find I cannot quit. Or when I start, I have little control over the amount I take in. I'm probably alcoholic, right? Now, I view alcoholism as a disease, just like I would view cancer or any other disease, and it's got different manifestations. My alcoholism manifested itself into an opiate addiction. And I would put them in my body, any kind, anywhere, by any means, right? I've shot them, I've snorted them, I've drank them, I've stuck them up my ass, you name the way, if it can get in there and get me to where I need to be quick, then I'll do it, right? But when I start drinking, I can't stop. And I always emphasize that because there are a lot of guys, the guys that run up here with me tonight are alcoholics, right? They are an alcoholic. I am just alcoholic. Meaning when I start anything, I can't stop. And the problem with that is, you know, detox would be my solution, but I got a mind that won't let me leave it alone. So I've got a body that won't tolerate them and a mind that won't leave it alone. And that isolates me from the rest of the population, right? The big book says we are an entity of our own, right? So I knew about alcoholism. Matter of fact, drinking was the last thing that I turned to because I grew up in an alcoholic household. My daddy was an alcoholic and he was a low bottom drunk and he was reaching his bottom when I came of age, right? He'd been in the military. He'd been in Vietnam. He had post-traumatic stress. He had all kind of shit going on mentally, and he loved drinking. And so I knew where alcohol would take you, right? Because, we grew up in a trailer park, and there was a lot of abuse. There was a lot of violence. We'd go months without lights. You know, he'd give him a check at the first of the month and go beat my mama's ass and she couldn't get none of it. And he'd drink it all up, so they'd cut the lights off. And there wouldn't be groceries in the house. And there'd be dog shit everywhere. And there'd be vomit. And there'd be all these things that you would expect to see in an alcoholic's house. Somebody that's low bottom. Right? And we're coming up to that. And there's nothing abnormal about that to us. Right? Remember, the alcoholic's life seems to be the only normal life. The thing about that is the people that come up behind me in my alcoholism, that is normal for them too. So although it was scary when I'd come home and my daddy'd be, or embarrassing, and my daddy'd be in the yards in his boxes with a pistol, just shooting at shit, drunk as hell at 3:00 in the afternoon, there was nothing abnormal about that. And the place that we were at, there seemed to be a lot of low-bottom people that kind of congregated into this same area, and they had similar situations that we were living in. So there was not like there was nothing to gauge what's right and what's wrong. Everybody just kind of had the same shit going on. And so the young people, myself included, in this neighborhood or trailer park, when things got tough at home, we kind of took to the streets. And we formed a little clique. That would probably call a gang today. But it was just a group of us that had similar situations and found acceptance with one another. And it was a diverse group of folks. There was blacks and whites and Hispanics. And I'm sure there were some gays and lesbians and whoever else. That just didn't matter. All that we knew is that we shared a common bond. And our home situation, the alcoholism in our homes, was that common bond. So we came together under that. And we started doing what little badass delinquent kids do, right? Keying cars and throwing rocks through windows and doing shit, being bad kids. Nothing major, unless you're the guy who owned the car or the fucking window, right? But to us, this is like petty. You know, who cares about this bay window I'm fixing to throw this damn boulder through? Now, we'd have little scrapes with the little neighborhood patrols and people in the neighborhood watching, the folks that's trying to keep, crowds like us at a minimum. But nothing major. And then, of course, as we got a little bit older, those consequences started getting a little bit more severe. The crime started getting a little bit more. It went from busting windows to home invasions and stealing cars and robbing stores and robbing drug dealers and doing things, it's escalating at times. Right? I smoked my first joint when I was 10 years old. And I found a peace about that. Now, it wasn't one of those moments where I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Because I knew I was going to do it the rest of my life. Everybody that I was around did that. So this wasn't abnormal behavior. It's just kind of what was going on. Right? Just like when the trouble started. I didn't see that as something bad. It's just, that's what this is. This is my life. This is what this looks like. I don't know any other way to see it. And I'm assuming that jails are coming. And then prisons are coming. And probably an early death is coming. But none of that's abnormal, right? Because I'm growing up in it. So at about 14 years old, it was suggested that my mother move me, I was in Savannah, moved me inland about 100 miles to Milton, that small town that I started grilling in. And it was the hopes that that would keep me out of trouble. And it worked to a degree, right? They moved me out. My grandmother had married a man that lived up in James County. And he was like a farm guy. And so he lived out in the middle of the country. We were like 15 miles from any town. One little old country store right down the road didn't sell no alcohol. Sold bread and hot dogs and little shit like that, candy bars. And I show up, unkempt, shoulder length hair. Don't brush my teeth, don't wash. Come from the streets, right? And my grandmother called me to the side when I first got there. And she said something to me that was the first time that I felt different than everybody else. And she said, "Stephen, when you're up here with these people, you can't talk about the things that you've done. And you can't talk about the things that your daddy's done because they'll judge you for it. And they'll judge me for it." Now, she wasn't trying to hurt me. She was trying to help me. She was trying to help me acclimate to this new society that I was fixing to find myself in. Right? This is like a fucking foreign country to me because everybody's sitting at the table at mealtime and they're holding hands and they're praying. And ain't nobody getting the shit slapped out of them. And we get up in the morning and we tend to our beds and we clean up. We got chores. We go to school. We get there on time. We get out the school bus. We do our homework. We go outside. We pull up turnips and we feed hogs and we feed cows and stack hay in the barn. And I loved it. Right? It was the first time in my life that I had any discipline or any structure, and I realized that's what I needed, right? They cut my hair. They prettied me up, right? Bought me some little, back in the day, little eyes odds, right? A pair of Brogans, because I'm a country boy. I wear Brogans to school. I had to wear the Huskies, right? Because I'm a Husky kind of guy. I couldn't wear the Levi's. I had to wear the big boy britches with the patches in the fucking. I had to cut off by that far, because I'm a short guy too, right? And they send me off to school, you know, and I've got a good personality. I'm laughing. I'm fun to be around, and I make lots of friends, and things start going really good, right? But nothing has been done to address. I'm sure, you know, if I look back now, 50 years later, 40, you know, 70 years later, I can see that I probably needed some counseling or some shit, man. I mean, I'm not sure. I didn't suffer post-traumatic stress syndrome. I don't know much about all that, but I did some crazy shit, right? And had some crazy thoughts and still do, you know, which is why this program is such a blessing to me, because I still have crazy thoughts. So I move up into this town, and what my grandmother told me started this little hint of fear inside of me, so I felt like an outsider. And I was always scared that if I let anybody inside close enough, they would discover that I wasn't what I was portraying myself to be, right? So I'm becoming dishonest as well. I can't be myself because I won't be accepted here. So I've got to act another way. And that was a deep-seated fear, and I didn't discover that's what it was until I did my first fourth step at 47 years old, right? I didn't realize all these things were hidden. All these things drove me and motivated me. What I did learn is that I was able to fit in with a whole bunch of different groups of people because I like to talk, and I like to laugh, and I like to joke. And I was the wildest one on the block. So all the little girls were attracted to me because they're a church community in the Bible Belt of Georgia, and I am not that. Right? I'm the one that your mama telling you, do not fuck with that kid right there. And of course, that's the one they're running to, right? And all the little boys have got, they got a little money in their pocket and they got nowhere to get nothing, so I knew where the dope was at. And in fact, then we just smoked a little reefer, you know, this is a late 70s, early 80s. And so we live out there in the country for a little while, and I really, man, I get most improved in school, and I, you know, my mama cleans me up and gets me looking good, and I'm doing really well, right? And then we move into this little small town where, you know, you've got access to, it's not like here, you know, but we got access to trouble, you know. And since I've got the same way of thinking that I've always had, this disease inside of me that has progressed to another stage, right? Because now it's not just smoking pot. Now I've added alcohol to the mix. Right? I'm not a take it away kind of person, right? Getting sober to Roscoe looks like I'm drinking too much. I'm going to start smoking meth. Right? Or I'm doing too much heroin or taking too many pills. I'm going to start drinking whiskey. Or I'm going to add some coke to the deal. Right? There was never getting sober. Abstinence, leaving substances alone, never entered into my mind. I couldn't understand that concept. It wasn't there. Right? I'm going to figure out how to do this and mix it with that and find that place, right? And what I didn't know, that as this thing progresses, it takes more and more, and those chemicals are so unstable, especially when you buy them on the street, that you're never going to find yourself in a hospital alive because you've done too much of one and not enough of the other one. And so I did all these experiments over these years, but my mind was unable to comprehend the idea that I needed to quit at all. And maybe at 21, 22 years old, I could have quit. But I didn't want to, right? Because I was having fun, man. This is when cocaine starts making its reemergence, you know, the early 80s. Miami Vice, everybody's Don Johnson, everybody's fucking Pablo Escobar selling damn grands. Falling around here, making out like they got it going on, like they something, you know, everybody got a gram of coke in their pocket. And then that devilish crack hit. And that changed the game, right? Crack changed the damn game. I was a senior in high school, and of course, even at that time, when somebody said, "Hey man, there's a drug out there, it'll get you higher and shit, it don't last about 10 seconds. You're going to spend every dime you got on it." I said, "Well, hell, where you get it?" Right. "I'm talking about it, let's be about it." And so, I'm up 17, 18, 19 years old. I'm running the streets hard. I'm probably an addict by this time, although I don't see it and would definitely not admit it. But I'm starting to suffer consequences where I'm at, too. I'm doing some jail time, some PDC for drinking and driving and carrying on. But still, you know, the mentality I had as a child that this is just what this looks like was still there. If I'm going to do these things, this is what that's going to look like. And I had no desire to stop, and I was willing to suffer the consequences. Back then, it was probably about every 4 or 5 years, I'd get hemmed up on something. It cost me a bunch of money, might cost me a little bit of time, but I was willing to suffer the consequences because I was having a good time, right? So I decided I'm going to go to college, even though I sucked in high school. But I'd gone to a party, some frat party, you know, at Georgia Southern, and I thought, damn, this is what I've been missing, right? Fuck school, I don't know if I even went to a class. But I borrowed a bunch of money and joined up and found the first party that was available. And then the next one, and then the next one, and I did that till they kicked me out. Then I went to another school and did the same thing. Then I went to another school until finally the dean at one of those schools said, "Man, I don't know whose money you wasted, but you got like a 0.07 GPA. So I don't even know if you know where the classroom's at. So you probably don't find you a job, right?" So I moved back, like, you know, drug addicts, dope fiends like me do. I moved back to my mama's house. I'm a grown-ass man by this time. Grown-ass man. Call my mama, she'll tell you, right? I'm going to move back in with my mama, who doesn't tolerate that kind of stuff. And so I do that, right? And I find me a little old job that pays just enough money to. Now I'm 20 years old, 21 years old, right? It's time to start making some steps towards being an adult. But I'm still, and all I want to do is make enough money to buy some reefer, buy a little coke, and buy some liquor. That's all my whole work life revolves around. Me getting to go out and party, me getting to do what I want to do. I'm sucking the life out of my mama, right? I'm eating her groceries, sucking up her air conditioning, right? Eating her food, laying on her couch like I'm the king, and spending all my money on the bullshit. And, I meet this gal, and she's one of those that's kind of, she was a preacher's daughter, and I wasn't that, and she was attracted to that, right, the wildness of it, and I think she thought maybe she could tame me out of that. I don't know exactly what her motives were. I know what mine were. And I partook every opportunity I got. And not just with her, but she ended up in the motherly way. Well, I'm not, you know, big on, I didn't know, have a religious background or anything, but I knew back then, 1992, 93, you're supposed to do the right thing, especially if I did as a preacher. So I decided to marry her, right? And so we get married. I don't have, my job pays like $5 an hour, right? She's in college. She's got a year left. Now she's with child. And we're going to try to, we're going to jump out here and be Ozzie and Harriet, right? We turned out being Ozzie and fucking Sharon, right? This is not a damn, it wasn't a match made in heaven. I don't even know that I like her. And I'm pretty sure she didn't like me. And I'm pretty sure she still don't like me. But anyhow, she has this baby, and I'm thinking, you know, it's probably time to start growing up, even though I got about a half acre of marijuana planted right behind my house. And by this time, I've figured out that if I'd start selling cocaine, I wouldn't have to pay for it. And so what I decided to do, because I thought this was the plan to end all plans, is I'm going to start selling cocaine out of my mailbox, which I found out was a federal offense. I'm going to sell cocaine out of my mailbox. And I lived up on kind of a hill, right? And I could see, going to the laundry room, I could see the mailbox. My wife couldn't see it, and the people coming to pick it up couldn't see me, right? So I thought I had this thing figured out. Well, my wife had graduated college by this time. She went to work for DFACS. And she was a DFACS caseworker. And so what that means is she worked cases against people. She went and took women's kids from them for doing the same shit that I was doing. Matter of fact, when they sent her to school for it, she'd be gone for a week and then come home for a weekend. And by the second week, she's doing this. And I'm sitting in the chair like, man. I thought, see, what the fuck is she looking at? Pulling my sleeves down. You know, this time I just started using an IV. And, you know, I'm like, what's she looking at? People just being, what the fuck is she looking at? Right? And so I come home from work one day, and I noticed that there's some Piggly Wiggly sacks over here that look like they have some clothes in them, but I ain't been a whole lot of it. And I walk in the kitchen, and she's in there doing motherly kitchen stuff, right? And she says, you'll never guess who I talked to today. And I said, I don't know. Who'd you talk to today? And she said this girl's name. I knew that was the end. Those were my clothes in the bag, right? I was selling cocaine to a girl that she was working a case against. And when she went to take her kids, she told her that. She said, you can't take my kids. Your husband is the one selling it to me. Mm-hmm. Right? And so now I'm scared because the fucking state's going to be involved. And I grabbed my bags and left. And that was the end of my first marriage. So that's a life-changing consequence. This thing has progressed from smoking a little weed in a fucking horse pasture to my wife and child leaving me because of drugs and alcohol. And it never registers in my mind that this may be a problem that's going to affect me and this child for the rest of my life. And that never occurred to me. It's like, okay, well, best way to get over one is to torment another one. I was going to say something else. There's a lot of women in here. Thank y'all for being here. I'm about 2 years into this divorce, and it's settled, and she got the house and all the things which she should have gotten, and the kid which she should have gotten, and I'm paying, you know, by this time I've gotten my degree, and I'm working in the field that I was working in, and so I'm making decent money now, and she's getting the better part of that, so I'm back. My mother passed away at this time, and now I'm back living at my grandmother's house, right? And I'm a grown-ass man, and I'm 28 years old, and I'm living with my grandmother. And I can't get past this thing, man. My ego is taking such a hit. I can't believe that this woman would run me off and take all my shit. Right? That's one of those, that's fourth column shit, right? Where were you to blame? Fuck, I wasn't. She's just a bitch. Right? I don't know why she left me. I mean, that wasn't, cocaine wasn't, that wasn't a big deal, man. I'm just doing a little bit, you know. So I get to thinking, man, my sister, I've got a sister that lives in the town above me, and she's got a bunch of friends. And I see Pam, my first wife, she's moved on and got her man in her life. And I say, man, I think I need to be a woman. So I called my sister and I said, hey, why don't you get together with some of your friends and see if you can't find somebody for me? And she said, the only requirement is that she be fully self-supporting through her own contributions. If she got kids, she got to take care of her own kids. Right? She got a house. I prefer that since I don't have one. She's got to be all right with me moving in her house. You know, if she's got a car, she needs to be paying for her own car. And I'm going to do what I've always done, right? Because I don't know any better. I've never seen what it looks like to be in a healthy relationship with anybody, but much less a woman, you know. And I've learned absolutely nothing from my first disastrous marriage. And I go into the second one with the same attitude. And this woman was a little bit more long-suffering. And in about 13 years, she told me she'd had enough. And I wrecked my company truck and destroyed my career, picked up some felonies, lost my license, lost my driver's license, you know. And 2007, all this stuff starts happening, right? This downhill slide starts happening. And even at that time, I knew I was unable to do anything about it. I couldn't equate it to powerlessness and bottoms and all that. I've never been to an AA meeting. I didn't know any of the language. I've never heard of the big book. All I knew was there was some maniac that was driving my life into the ground, and there was nothing I was going to be able to do to stop it. I was going to have to ride it out. And wherever it ended is where it was at. And it took 7 years. So June the 26th of 2014, I'm sitting in a little 8x10 self-made prison cell. It was actually a block building behind one of my sister's houses. And I've got one TV that's got one channel. And I've got this little tray, like an aluminum dinner tray. And on that tray is a black porcelain plate with an 8-ball of cocaine already cut out on it. And beside that is 12 stacks of 10 methadone tablets. And in front of that is a quart of moonshine. And these are all the things, this combination of things up to this point were the things that I used to make me get normal. I could never get high anymore. I didn't have the money to do that. All I could do was get well. And I couldn't get well. And I'm sitting there, man, and I'm shooting this dope, and I'm eating these pills, and I'm drinking this liquor. And nothing's working. And I had a .44 Magnum that I had allegedly acquired in a home invasion. Allegedly. But I did have the pistol. And I've heard people talk about the gift of desperation. And I think that is a gift. It's a blessing, right? But the thing about desperation is I still got one move to make. Right? I'm not done. I still got one thing I can do. And so I'm sitting there with that pistol, and I'm cocking it back to safety and letting off the trigger, and I'm trying to build the courage to pull the hammer back so I can shoot myself, right? That's the only thing. Out of all these years and all this education and all this shit, that the very best thing I can offer myself to get out of the situation that I put myself in is to shoot myself in the face. That's it. That's the best thing I got. And I can't do it. So I put the gun down, and I sit back in that chair. I don't know what to do, right? So I keep doing what I do. Finally, the methadone liquor overtake, the cocaine. I roll over and fall out on this damn little mat I got. No sheets, no pillowcases, dog shit everywhere, rotten food. But this tray is immaculate. Phone's all shined up, right? I ain't gonna miss the fucking dope man's call. Right, I got a burner. Right? It's my 10th one this week. But I got a goddamn phone. I ain't talking. My dog's number ain't in it. I couldn't tell you how to get in touch with my child. But I got my 3 drug dealers' numbers in it. Right. Everything's immaculate. My world is this big. And I look up and everything else, man, is a disaster. I roll over and go to sleep. Wake up next morning, do the same thing, ain't nothing changed, start drinking, take some of the methadone, give me a shot of coke, go to work, About 10:30, a guy catches me, and that wasn't the first time it happened. This time he says some things that strike me, and the thing that he said that bothered me the most was, I used to look up to you. Now I don't even know who you are. And I said, the first true statement I ever said, I said, man, do you really think I want to be this way? I mean, you think I can't look back and see my life? Two failed marriages, a tanked career, loss of respect from you guys, from my peers, from my community. People see me coming, they turn away. Do you think I don't know why I do the things that I do? I have no idea. All I know is I can't stop. And he said, well, why don't you call your sister? I had a sister that got sober 10 months before me. And any other time in my life, I said, I ain't calling that bitch. She thinks she's better than me. She done got AA, bad, bad, you know. But this time I said, okay. So I called her. And she don't answer. Because the last time she answered, cost about $3,000. So put the phone down. I said, she ain't answer. I'll call her back later. He said, no, man. Text her. Any other time, up to that moment, I said, I told you, man, I'll call her later. This time, I said, okay. I text her. She still got the text. I'm tired. I'm ready to get sober. As soon as I sent the text, the phone rings. She asked me if I was serious. I said, yeah. She said, go home. I'll be there in 3 hours. She lived in Cumming. She said, I'll be there in 3 hours. I said, okay, man, I'm done, right? So now I'm feeling relieved. I'm feeling good. I'm finally done with all this dope. Although I'm doing dope at the time. And I get to thinking. I send this guy out there because I can't go quit my job. I'm drunker than shit. Blood not coming out my arm. And I said, go up there and tell him I'm going to rehab. I'm quit. And get my checks, right? And so 3 minutes after I said I am done, I have a thought. Man, I better call that drug dude about $120. I better call him and tell him right out here, let me pay him for that. And since he's coming, I think I'm going to bring that 8-ball. Right? So in 3 minutes, I went from I'll never get high again to buying an 8-ball of cocaine. Right? Now, later on, a month down the road, 6 weeks down the road, I learned what that was. At the time, that was normal. That didn't seem insane to me. It didn't seem out of the ordinary to me. That was what I would do. I had no second thinking about it. That's just what I do. So she drives my ass to Miami, Florida, because I can't get anywhere else. I don't have any driver's license or form of identification to detox. And on the day I'm about to get out, I'm sitting in my room. This is I've gone 4 days this time past the Valium, which is longer than I've been in 30 years probably. And I'm scared because the program she has picked out is 30 days. And I'm thinking, man, I don't think 30 days is long enough. I've been doing this shit for 30 years. But I don't know what to do. So I'm going to do it. I'm just going to go along with it. The next morning, I get a phone call from my sister. Said, I found you a long-term place, 6 months, called Bridges of Hope. It's in Louisville, Georgia. And the first thought I had was, man, that's crazy. I was just thinking about that last night. And the next thought I've had was, 6 months, man, what are you freaking kidding me? Fucking 6 months, my life would be a train wreck in 6 months. And she said, your life is a fucking train wreck. Okay. Right? I landed at this place. The only thing they offered is there wasn't no doctors, there wasn't no psychiatrists, wasn't no psychologists. Only thing we had at the Bridge of Hope was that book right there. And the man gave it to me and said, see if you find yourself in it. See, we were required, if you're under 30 days, you got to sit back then in front of this TV, catty-corner and dining hall, and read your big book 10 minutes before every meal. It's not optional. It's not debatable. You sit and read your book, and if you ain't reading your book, somebody walks by and says, read your fucking book! Right? It's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, you know. Well, we won't stop. And so I was introduced for the first time to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I started reading, and it was, you know, worded, dated back in the day, and some of the wording was, you know, above me or beyond me. Most of it was beyond me. But I highlighted the stuff that I understood, the stuff that I could relate to at that moment, right? And then I got involved with an old man who started taking me through the steps, right? He actually started explaining what this is to me and what that looks like and how my feet work and how what the things that we do on the Bridges of Hope are exactly what the big book's saying, right? We're practicing the principles of recovery by getting up and being up on time and being where we're supposed to be and doing what we're supposed to be doing while we're there. And he said, all these are spiritual principles and you're doing them. Right? Because the only idea I had of God at the time, a power greater than myself, was the Bridges of Hope. Right? I had a 13-second experience with God. And I didn't know how I was going to turn my will and my life over to Him. Right? So I thought, well, maybe this place can be that for right now. Maybe these rooms can be that. Maybe this fellowship can be that right now until I find something bigger. And I find something better and something more sustainable, because that's something that's right there that would get high. Right? And so I started doing that, man. I sat down and I read the rules. And I tried my best to follow them. And I started working the steps. And as I got to a certain point of step, my fifth step, actually, and I told some things on myself that I've been holding on to since I was 7, 8 years old, I started to see the information that was coming into my mind was different. My perception was starting to change. And the conversations I was having with people were starting to change. And I was no longer concerned with the idea that I need to go home and jump on this first job that comes up that's going to pay me the most amount of money, or I need to go out there and try to find me another woman, or where am I going to live, or where am I going to drive? All I need to be worried about is, how's this guy doing to sit in the first chair? What can I do to be of service to him? And the rest of this stuff will take care of itself, right? So, it's 6 months. It gets time to leave. And nothing is showing itself. So I asked my higher power at the time, which at the time was not me. And that's what I called it. I'd had some experiences with it, but I still wasn't the God guy. I said, not me. I need some guidance. Right? And I had created all these little obstacles in my path. Of justifications, excuses why I needed to bail on what I was doing right now and go do something else, right? I'm creating, I need to make some money, I need to do all this stuff, right? And so I go out back one day and I ask, not me, I need some guidance and some, you know, I need some help. I don't know what to do. And I go, and that day I'm laying on my bunk and open up this book and it says, be still, know I am God. And I went, yeah, well, I don't think I'm supposed to see that. So, well, next day, same thing. Not me, I need some guidance. I need some help. I don't know what I'm supposed to do next. I'm going into Louisville, and there's a Catholic church. And it's got a sign out in front of it. I've been by this church a million times. And I happened to look at that sign that day, and it said, be still. Know I am God. And I thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to be still. Right? So I was still. 3 months came and went. I'm back in that frame of mind. Man, I got to get out of here. I'm 47, about to be 48 years old. I need to get out and rebuild my life. Right? I need to get out and do something. I need to do something. I go outside and say, God, I need some direction. I need some guidance. I don't know what to do. I come back from work that day, and I walk into the office of the manager at the time and said, Roscoe, we like having you around here. I found you a scholarship. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm not costing anybody any money. My excuse was my sister's paying for me to be here. She agreed to 6 months, not 9. Right? So I'm going to get off her tip. Excuse me for saying that. Teeth. And the point is that obstacle was removed. Mm. for me. So now there's a path being established, right? It's becoming evident to me that if I continue to be of service, if I live in the fifth tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, my primary purpose is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. If I would just do that and don't allow issues of property, power, and prestige and that other P word, peanut butter, jump on my damn, get in my head. If I will leave that alone, these things will present themselves to me. Right? They'll fall in front of me, and then I have a decision to make. Right? And it's going to always be a leap of faith because I don't know what's down that road. I can only look back and see where I came from. I can see behind me as clear as day, but I can't see in front of me. And in these times when nothing's happening, because I like the stuff to be happening right now, yesterday, I get scared and I get nervous. And I have to rely on this power that I've found to guide me and direct me. And he always tells me, just keep doing what you're doing, man. Just keep doing what you're doing. And sure enough, I'll put all that out of my mind. I'll take another step forward. And there's the next thing. And so I do that. And then I look back, how damn if it don't line up pretty with everything behind me. But see, I don't know how to get from where I'm at to where I'm supposed to be. Because I don't know where I'm supposed to be. All I know is that I've got a power in my life that will direct and guide me if I allow it to do it. And thus far, my life has gotten better. Right? I'm standing on a porch of this house that is provided for me. And I'm looking out over this pond. It's built up on a hill overlooking a pond. And there's a lot of cedar trees around it, right? There's a big old full moon shining down on that pond. It's like a picture. And I'm talking to this woman that I've been in a relationship with for about 5 years. Who loves me. She thinks I'm the shit, right? And I have no idea why she would think that. But she does, right? 5 years ago, we've never raised our voice at one another. We treat each other with mutual respect and kindness and understanding. If one of us is wrong, we take the high road, right? We're in a God-centered relationship. Greatest thing ever, right? I'm talking to her on the phone, and I've got a brand new vehicle sitting over here in the yard that's provided for me. My phone I'm talking on had the same number. The phone was 10 years. And I'm thinking, man, everything I've ever wanted, I've got. I live on a beautiful piece of land, 150 acres, in a brand new house, driving brand new vehicles. I can hear my facility down there about 100 yards from it with my family. These men down there laughing, playing guitars, joking, having a good time. I smell fresh meat cooking. Everything I've ever wanted. See, because I thought that the house that I bought was my house. That wasn't my house. That was the bank's house. The cars I drove were the bank's cars, right? The house I live in now on paper isn't Stephen Rothborough's house. It's the Bridges of Hope's house. The vehicle I drive, a brand new truck, isn't Stephen Rothborough's truck. It's the Bridges of Hope's truck, right? The phone's mine, but I mean, it ain't bad 10 years, right? Everything I've ever wanted, I have. And the only thing I've done was found God as my understanding. I've kept him close to me. And I've performed his work to the best of my ability. And everything else has fallen in place. It's the most stress-free place I've ever been. I've made tons more money in my life. I never had tons more money. Right? But I made it. Right? I've probably been more popular than I am now. Especially these guys come in and bring us up new. And they're sitting in front of me about where Cinco's sitting. And I'm standing up. Rah, 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 damn it, rah. And drop me in the nut house. And that's a head nut. You know? But I've built some really good, solid relationships. A lot of us out here right now, man. A lot of them in here right now. And there's never a time that I call that they don't pick up and vice versa. Right? There's never a time that we're not there for one another. And that's something I never had. Right, I sat in jail cells waiting on somebody to put some money on my books. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. All my friends ain't my friends. But I bet if I was getting locked up tomorrow, they'd probably be disappointed in me, but they'd put some money on my books, right? These are my brothers. These are my sons. Every relationship I'm in, I learned how to be in through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a relationship with you guys, the relationship with my sisters, with my daughter, with my grandchildren now, with my ex-wives, who I don't like to call ex-wives. They're both great women. Very good. They deserve way more than what they got. All right? With the people that I work with the people that I work for, every bit of that's made possible through the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And I'm grateful for it. And I'm grateful for y'all letting me come out and tell the story. Thank you. Where the sweat, huh?